Animation is a labor of love, a collaboration between hundreds of artists, writers, and dreamers. One person can make a suggestion in a meeting that results in an indelible image that moviegoers will see decades later and then never forget. Christmas, 1925. Walt Disney gave his wife Lillian a gift, a puppy in a hat box, an apology for long nights spent away working on cartoons. Joe Grant gave Walt a pitch in 1937 about his spaniel named Lady, neglected in favor of a new baby in the house. By the 1940s, Walt had read a short story by Ward Green about Happy Dan the Whistling Dog, and now our Lady had a suitor. There was freedom in not adapting a well-known fairy tale and creating their own joyful story of two dogs falling in love. The threads were sewn together over the years by hundreds of collaborators, and after decades in development, the film was back in production by 1952, with a budget of $2.5 million, and would become the first animated film released in CinemaScope. Premiering June 22, 1955, Lady and the Tramp was the most successful Disney movie since Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but open to mixed reviews from critics. The New York Times claimed that this was not Disney's best. It was too sentimental, and the CinemaScope technique made the characters look ugly. It's hard to believe that this was the critical reaction of the time, since Lady and the Tramp is now considered one of the 25 all-time best animated films by Time magazine and one of the 100 greatest love stories of all time by the American Film Institute. 70 years ago, two dogs shared a plate of spaghetti and an accidental kiss, and we've never been the same since. I'm Violet Hammond, and today, our panel collaborates on three circles to celebrate and reevaluate Lady and the Tramp on its movieversary. Welcome to Three Circles, a podcast on Disney movies, and to Movieversaries for this special crossover episode. I'm Violet Hammond, and I'm joined by the Wally to my Eve, my Three Circles co-host, Jeff Owen. How are you today, Jeff?
I'm doing good. Thank you, Violet. How are you doing today?
Oh, I am just peachy keen. So ready to get into our topic today. And since this is a crossover on Movieversaries, we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. And on this episode, we're discussing Lady and the Tramp, the Walt Disney animated classic on its 70th anniversary. And we're pleased to welcome my Movieversaries co-host, Ian Buckley. Hi, Ian.
Hey, glad to be back. Good to talk to you as always.
Yes, thanks for being here. And to round out our panel for this special episode, we're joined by Jeff's stage wife and a connoisseur of classic Disney movies. Please welcome Donna Jones. Donna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be such a good time. I've been really looking forward to doing this. And the first question we ask our guests on Movieversaries is, what does this film mean to you? Donna, would you like to answer first?
I'd love to. For me, I think Lady and the Tramp is one of those films that's such a soft and warm film. It's really got, it's a lovely message, but it's not told in a way that's just too brash or too loud. It's just got a gentleness about it. And I think that that's something that is lost a little bit in films these days, you know, that gentle, quiet storytelling and that very subtle warmth. So it's special to me. It's such a comfort movie to me.
Yes, it is like a total cozy core watch for real. Ian, what does this film mean to you?
Very similar. I think this might have been, you know, one of the earliest, certainly one of the earliest Disney movies that I became very attached to. It was on repeat quite a lot, especially when I was very young. It really is just a very, like you said, cozy, comforting watch. My dear Aunt Kathy when I was younger. She had a couple of Cocker Spaniels, and they were just such delightful dogs. And so, of course, this movie was frequently in rotation when I was over visiting her house. And I just, yeah, like revisiting it, it was probably the first time in about maybe 10, 15 years that I had seen it. And it just warms your heart, just makes you feel good. And of course, the cultural stereotypes are always fun.
Oh, don't worry, we're getting into it. That is definitely on the docket for today. Jeff, what does this film mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much been said already. And, I'd seen the film when I was a lot younger. It was at the time when Disney were only periodically releasing films in the cinema. So, unless you saw it in the cinema, you weren't seeing it. There was no video release until quite a bit later on. But I guess I must have thought I knew the film better than I did, because when I went back and watched it, I remember a couple of memories from the film itself, and it felt like I was watching it again for the first time, and it was such an enjoyable watch. I know I'd seen the remake a few years ago. Let's move on from that for the moment. But the memories were both of good and bad memories of the films. I remembered the iconic spaghetti scene and the Siamese cat song, which I'm sure we'll get onto as the conversation goes on.
Yeah, we definitely will. As for me, much the same as all of you. I remember watching this when I was a kid. The spaghetti scene is something that will never leave my mind. It's adorable and it's so cute. I hadn't seen this in a very long time when I watched Prepare for this podcast, and it really was such a charming, fun watch. My son came and sat down next to me on the couch and finished watching the movie with me. He came in about halfway through, and even he said, "God, I forgot how good this is." I said, "I know. It's really, really good. It's such a good time watching it. It was fun." But we keep saying we're going to get into it. We're going to get into it. So let's get into it. Donna, what's your first circle?
My first circle that I wanted to talk about is the music.
Yes.
Unsurprisingly.
Right.
Of course, I want to talk about the music. It's just, there are really iconic songs in this film, but it's not the kind of soundtrack that you hear often. It's not with a lot of Disney, you hear the princess songs quite often and the I Want songs quite often, and it's just a little different because there isn't really the iconic I Want song in this, where somebody tells you about their dreams and their wishes. But it does have some very romantic songs like Bella Notte when they have the spaghetti scene, which is a beautiful song. And of course, the lovely Peggy Lee co-wrote a lot of the songs in this. She co-wrote He's a Tramp and the La La Loo Lullaby as well. And she was specifically picked by Disney because of her songwriting abilities. I think she wrote something like over 270 songs. She's not that well known for her songwriting, but if you dig into it, she wrote hundreds of songs, and Disney brought her on board because of that skill that she had to create a character through a song, which is something that is quite a unique skill. She also voiced characters in the film.
Yes, she did.
Like, obviously, she's Peg the dog, but she's also Darling and Siamese Cats, I believe, as well.
She is. Yep.
But just that, having that jazz background in it, and I think it just contrasts so nicely with the classic animated style. It's just really charming, and its musical storytelling, I think, is really special.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that because you get the songs are not just ornamental. You get storytelling through the song, like specifically He's a Tramp, where you're like, oh, we're getting his whole backstory.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
you have to pay attention to the lyrics because they're going to tell you the story, which at this point in Disney films, they weren't always using the songs as a storytelling technique. And it's definitely really cool. Yeah. Peggy Lee is. There's a lot to say about her in this one, but Ian, do you have any thoughts on the music?
Yeah, I love the music, and I definitely wanted to shout out Peggy Lee, so I'm glad that you guys already did. I had, like I said, I hadn't seen this in a while and I had forgotten just how musical it was. Like I, remembered a couple of musical interludes and moments, but I had really just forgotten how lovely the soundtrack of the movie is as well. Even though it's not one of those like big di like if I was to think of like, oh, what are the musical Disney films or the films with really memorable music, like this is not one that I would think of right away. I would think of, probably the ones in the 90s that I grew up with first, but certainly a lovely element to rediscover.
Yeah, definitely. Jeff, anything you want to say about the music?
Peggy Lee just absolutely steals this film. Her singing voice is amazing. And it's weird that the song that we remember from this film is the one that they didn't put in the remake because, for obvious reasons, it's very
No kidding.
problematic. But I remember as a kid in the 80s and 90s, that would be on Disney albums, that would be on Disney shows, that they still hadn't quite got past the fact that it was problematic,
Yeah.
and that song would show up. He's a Tramp would show up a lot as well, because that's just a wonderful jazz piece as well. Yeah, the Siamese Cat song, it was everywhere, and looking back it's like, why that song? But yeah, anyway, it's fantastic, and I'm so glad that you mentioned Peggy straight away, Donna, because, well, yeah, we're gonna have to talk about her.
Yeah, for
Absolutely.
sure. I mean, she was my first circle too, but I have backups, don't worry. Like Peggy Lee was just an unbelievable part of this movie. On Movieversaries, we like to talk about favorite facts. So I'm just gonna throw my favorite fact out here right now since we're talking about her. Trusty actually survives in the movie due to her objections.
Yes.
Because
Oh.
when Walt Disney showed her the storyboards, she was weeping because he died. And she said, "You can't kill him. He needs to survive. You can't do this. You can't do this to me. You can't do this to the kids." So he survives in the movie just for Peggy Lee.
I didn't
Oh,
know that. That's
I
fun.
didn't know that.
Isn't that sweet?
Good old
Yes.
Peg.
She also took on Disney too. She sued Disney for breach of contract and unpaid royalties from the VHS sales in 1988, and she won close to $4 million from Disney in 1992.
Yeah, she had a clause in her contract at the time, apparently, that prevented Disney from making transcriptions for sale to the public, which was, things like song books and things like that. And they wouldn't have done anything like home video releases at the time, so it wasn't a thing when it was signed. She held the rights to phonograph recordings of the songs. It was determined to apply to this. She won 2.3 million for breach of contract, 500,000 for unjust enrichment, 600,000 for illegal use of Lee's voice, and 400,000 for use of her name. Of the $72 million Disney earned in video cassette sales, Lee's award was about 4% of the entire take-ins.
Wow.
She took them on.
Yeah,
She
and one.
given how did
popular
it.
this VHS was, I'm not surprised she made that much.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Good for
Awesome.
her.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly. Good for it's like that gift from Arrested Development. Good for her.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Ian, what is your first circle?
Well, since you guys already shouted out the music and Peggy Lee, I'm going to talk about the sort of supporting cast. I had basically forgotten about Trusty and Jock. Like I remembered them in vague terms, but I had just forgotten how present they are in the movie, in the narrative, and how charming these performances are. That just it just feels like, classic Disney supporting characters. It feels just as comforting as these other elements. Like these performances and characters just feel like just warm blankets of Disney characters. I just like no wonder she spoke up in defense of Trusty. I think that would have been a really sort of down note to end the story on, and I'm glad that it just wouldn't have quite fit this type of story that they're trying to tell. So I'm glad they made that change. But I loved Jock, played by Bill Thompson, and Trusty, played by Bill Baucom. And I had just totally forgotten about these wonderful supporting characters. And of course, the other dogs too, like Peg and, you know, Dachi and all them. But Jock and Trusty are like the through lines. So I wanted to focus on them.
Yeah, I love that. I'd forgotten how much they were in it too. I had the same thought as you as we were watching it. Donna, do you have any thoughts on Jock and Trusty?
I just love how this Jock, I think, is my favorite. I just love the accent. And it's funny to me how the Siamese cats are seen as so problematic and stereotypical, but Jock is fine.
Oh,
And I
well,
find
we're
that
very
strange.
pro the Siamese cat performances too on this podcast. We should say that. Like, we're very
Okay.
in favor of what they were going for there. No
Yeah.
notes.
I think that it's always something that comes up when people talk about Lady and the Tramp is about the cats. But I mean, there's a lot of cultural stereotyping in Jock as well. But maybe it's because he's a nice, soft character, whereas the Siamese cats are the villains, maybe. I don't know.
I think the nature of the character has something
Yeah.
to do with the way that's viewed, because those cats are not, those cats are clearly like the villains of the piece, if there are some, and they're the sneaky, conniving, can't be trusted, plotting kind
Yeah.
of characters. And obviously, when you tie that with the kind of stereotype depiction that you're having in this movie, like, that's where I think people have, such a big problem with those characters.
Yeah.
Not that they wouldn't if they were positive, nice characters, but the fact that they aren't is a big part of why those portrayals have been sort of so thoroughly rejected now.
Jeff, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just to continue on that thought about
Yeah.
the portrayals of, other races. We also get the Chihuahua dog as well, who is practically Speedy Gonzales in all but
Yeah.
name. No, sorry, he's not Speedy Gonzales. It was his, what was his cousin, Slowpoke?
Oh. Oh,
I
gosh, I
can't
don't
remember his
remember.
name, but he was very sort of laid back type Mexican character. You got the German dog as well, the German wolfhound, I think, and
The
even Tramp
Russian.
put on an I the Russian, yeah, and Tramp put on an Irish accent as well at one point.
Yep.
It's a very multicultural film, and of course we've got the English bulldog
Yep.
too as well. So that's strange, actually. English, Irish, Scottish, no Welsh.
No Welsh. Should have
Lady
had a
and the
little.
Tramp must do
You should.
better.
You should have had a little corg, little Welsh corgi.
Welsh corgi, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, I mean, we're hitting all my circles, but that's okay because then we can just keep on going. But I'll just throw in here now that I had that this is supposed to be turn of the 20th century in New England, but it may as well be a United Nations summit with all of the
Right.
accents in this movie. Like it is distracting and it's viewing it through today's eyes. It's a little distracting. And yes, on Movieversaries, we talk about shortcomings. And yes, the shortcoming is that this suffers from the unfortunate stereotyping in films from this era. On Disney Plus, at one point, Jeff and I just checked before we started recording. It's not on there now, but at one point on Disney Plus, there was a content warning that read negative depictions and/or mistreatment of people or cultures. So at one point, they were pointing out that this was not good. Right now, they're just warning us about tobacco use. But hey, sure. Okay, Jeff, it's time for your first circle.
Well, I'm going to read out the first part of my notes here
Cool.
just to predict what I thought was going to happen straight away on here. I want to say Peggy Lee, but I know Donna will already have talked about her, so I'm not going to steal her thunder.
Oh, thank you.
However, I do want to talk about the mannerisms and personalities of all of the animals we see in the film, not the stereotypical characters, just the way they're portrayed. And it must have been so tempting to make them anthropomorphic, stand on two legs. But we see them as dogs, as cats, as pigeons, as a rat. You know, we see Lady grow up from this adorable young puppy to this older dog. And Lady as a puppy is so adorable. I just want to pick her up and cuddle her. She's so
Yeah,
cute.
I know.
She immediately takes over, gets a place on the bed, which seems to be where she spends all of her time afterwards when Jim Deere and Darling are home, despite Jim Deere trying to lock her into the room with some newspaper down.
Oh.
We get introduced to Tramp, who gets out of the barrel he's been sleeping in and stretches. And it's a perfectly natural dog stretch. Peg's a wonderful streetwise Pekingese. Trusty's a wonderful elderly bloodhound. It's fascinating how developed the animal characters are as well, on a side note, and how little we know of the humans. We don't even know their names, just what they call each other. And we barely even see their films for most of the film because it's seen from the dog's point of view.
Yes.
It is a little jarring when you first hear Lady and Jock talk for that first time, though, because up until that point, you hadn't heard the dogs talking. They were just dogs. And on the other side, we get the sheer brutality in the animation of the dog fight, where Lady Tramp defends Lady from the street dogs. And then later on, when Tramp saves the baby from the rats, he limps out from under the curtains, literally licking his wounds. The animation style in this is just amazing, from soft and adorable to brutal and visceral.
Yes, totally, totally agree. Ian, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I honestly think the same thing about the animation. I really enjoyed how, it has that very classical Disney feel, but they can shift modes in terms of the kind of mood they're trying to evoke with the animation. And Jeff's right. I think them being able to shift tonally back and forth from, God, I don't know what word I'd use to describe it, not quite sharp, but you have angles and harsh shadows and things like that in these sort of more actiony sequences. They're very impressionistic. And then you have the, wonderful, rich, warm color and detail of most of the rest of the film, which is in keeping with the tone that they're trying to set for the majority of it. So yeah, I really agree. I think the animation is fantastic.
Donna, do you have anything to add? I just wanted to add that it's really charming to actually go back and watch these classic Disney films and know that they were all hand painted and hand animated, you know?
Yeah.
Not that
Right.
I don't think the ones we have today are fantastic, but I think for this kind of story in particular, where it's warmer and cozier, that hand-drawn feel really just gives it a lovely, I don't know. It's a completely different sense. It's just a warmer tone to it all because you know that it's been, made with such love and attention.
Yeah, exactly. And I will add that I forgot how scary that rat fight is at the end.
Right?
You
Yeah.
feel like there's like real stakes in that scene. It's scary and it's drawn so well. That is a really effective scene.
The rat apparently was meant to have been this comedic character in early
Yeah.
developments of the script, and they just went away from that completely. And I think the film is so much better for doing that, because it's that the rat is this evil character in the film, and
Yeah.
I don't think that ending would have worked as well if he was a funny character, you know?
No, not at all.
No, I
Not at
agree.
all. Yeah, I think the color palette is really. I love how it shifts between the two worlds, and you've got like Lady's domestic world. There's lots of pastel tones, and there's lots of hints of pink, and there's these lovely just baby colors, pinks and blues. And then when we have the scenes with Tramp, it's a lot murkier. The colors are a lot earthier and darker, and it really helps you switch between the two worlds in your mind.
Yes, definitely. Well, for my first circle, I'll piggyback on you talking about the cast, Jeff. So, this voice cast, there's so many familiar Disney voices in there that Barbara Luddy is Lady, and she was also Meriwether, Kanga, and Mother Rabbit in one of my favorites, Robin Hood.
Wow, okay.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's like that's almost the first thing that I thought, because I've been talking, well, not to give too much away, but I've had a couple of den attends with Sam lately, and Robin Hood may have come up a couple of times. So when I heard her start talking, I was like, oh my gosh, it's Mother Rabbit. Like, I actually got that one before Kango, which is strange. But Larry Roberts as Tramp, Disney had wanted him specifically to embody the spirit of like Cary Grant. Like, he should look like some kind of, like, he should be like the handsome scoundrel dog on the street. And it was, I think, a success. Like, he is such a charismatic character, and it's a great voice performance. And I also want to shout out that Alan Reed, who was the Russian dog at the pound, later became the voice of Fred Flintstone.
Yeah, I've got that
And
note.
you got that one too. Yep. And Stan Freberg was also in Winnie the Pooh, and you could hear his whistle when he talked. He is
He's the
the,
beaver in this, isn't
yep,
he?
the whistle. Yeah, I caught that one too. I was like, oh, I'm like, I know this. So there's, it kind of adds to the cozy feeling of the film, all of these familiar voices that you heard in your childhood. And you're like, oh, there you are, you're back. There you are, Peter. Ian, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I'd agree. When I was looking up, like, what do I know Barbara Luddy from? I was like, oh, right. Like, she's just one of those Disney mainstays, especially from this era where she'd pop up in Winnie the Pooh and pop up in Sleeping Beauty and in this film. And, I remembered especially having the feeling, even if I couldn't, like you, pinpoint, oh, I recognize that voice from this other film. It took me back to just the sound of this era of Disney filmmaking, not just what they were when they were made, but also when I watched them, which would, Robin Hood was definitely in the rotation early on, just like this one was. Just like, Cinderella was and Sleeping Beauty and some of the other classics. And so, yeah, some of these voice actors who popped up in different projects, it all contributed to the kind of Disney sound that I could identify with.
Yes, 100%. Donna, do you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize that there were so many crossovers until recently. It's kind of one of those things, once you start going down the rabbit hole of looking up a familiar voice, then it just connects like a big web, and it's really exciting when you hear it, you discover you're right.
Exactly. It's like finding a clue. Jeff,
Yeah.
anything to add?
Warm blanket of voices and the
Yes.
familiar voices, and it's like you're in safe hands with a lot of the voices that turn up. I didn't recognize Fred Flintstone at the time, though. It was only when looking through the notes and Wikipedia articles that I went, "Oh my God, yes, it is."
Yes.
But you hear the voices, and it's like, "Oh yeah, I know the voices," and you don't know where from, but they're comfortable, they're nice, they're familiar, and it's nice to hear these voices again. It's like there's a lot of modern voice actors, people like Billy West and John DiMaggio, and you'll hear them on everything turning up, and it's like you see their name attached to something, and you go, oh yeah, we're in good company, we're in good hands here, because they know what they're doing. Yeah, completely agree. It's a wonderful voice cast.
Yes. Donna, what's your second circle?
My second circle that I wanted to talk about was the use of food and as a means of connection. And there's obviously there's the classic scene with the spaghetti and meatballs, and it's so charming and so cute. There's no other word for it. It's just cute, and it's just pure storytelling through food. I mean, when they share that dinner together, there's is showing that they're sharing a part of each other's lives and showing how their different lives are intertwining. When we see the dogs being fed throughout the film, you know, Lady's world is very prim. So her meals are very structured and they serve to her so beautifully. And it's completely different from Tramp's world, where he's just scavenging wherever he can find. And then when they sort of have that moment with the spaghetti and meatballs. It's very light-hearted, but it's one of the most romantic film scenes I think of all time. You know, the way he sort of nudges the little meatball towards her and the unexpected kiss. It's really cozy, and that shared moment of connection, which we see often in film, you know, showing connection through food. But I think Lady and the Tramp is my favorite example of it.
Oh, I love that. Oh, that's amazing. Ian,
It's
do you have
just
anything to
romantic.
add?
Other than that was going to be my next circle,
Oh,
basically.
well,
No,
what?
I
Go.
completely endorse everything you just said. I mean, I think that scene with the spaghetti has become so iconic, was so iconic when I grew up. I mean, like that was like one of my sort of like little growing up little touchstones of like, oh, like this is romantic. Like this is what this signifies. And it just sort of like became a part of my, tapestry of understanding the spectrum of human emotion and experience. Like it was a very early little visual marker in figuring out how I felt about that and the world. And I think it has, that visual power that you were talking about, the visual storytelling, it sort of breaks that what we know as adults is a very complex process of finding your person, and it just distills it down to a couple of really singular images and sequences in a way that I think still retains a lot of the power that it had when it first came out. So I completely endorse everything you just said.
Oh, beautiful. Jeff, anything to add to this?
Did you know that the original version of the spaghetti scene was originally left on the cutting room floor?
No.
Um,
I
can you
did hear
imagine?
something, but you'll know more about it than me.
Apparently Walt Disney himself said it didn't work and removed it from the film and put in
Oh.
something else. Frank Thomas, one of the animators, just basically found it and went, there's something here. And he reanimated that whole scene himself. And what you see then in the film is what he did. And Walt Disney even then looked at his reworked animation and went, yeah, you're right. This is a lot more romantic than what was there before. And because of that, it's now one of the most indelible romantic scenes in cinematic history.
Right.
So yeah, it's in a different universe, that scene doesn't exist, or it's an
Oh.
older,
Wow.
poorer version of the scene. So
Wow. My goodness. Oh, well, Ian, do you have a backup circle number two?
I guess I'll talk just a little bit about something that struck me as I was watching it, just in a kind of big picture sense. I don't re recall, there probably are some, but for me, this was certainly the first and one of the earliest depictions of the kind of, secret life of pets or animals idea being like portrayed on screen, or the ideas that's like Toy Story explores of like, what are these characters getting up to when the people aren't around, and how can we represent that in ways that are funny or interesting or dramatic? And so I know that as a kid, especially who loved animals, I still do, and loved cats, loved dogs, loved all the animals, and was just really taken by, as I think a lot of children and adults are, by this concept of, oh, like when the people aren't around, like these animals have their own inner lives and their own adventures, and what are they getting up to when we're not around, and how are they communicating with each other? Like if we could understand what they were saying to one another, what would that be? Like that was a really compelling idea for me as a kid, and so that was definitely something that I locked into from an early age about this movie and about movies like this, especially like, and I was a big like Homeward Bound fan as a kid. Like I just loved the idea of like animals talking and going on their own adventures while people weren't around.
Oh, That's so true. And it's funny because it's really kind of like Disney slash Pixar bread and butter now. Like, what are your
Yeah.
cars doing and thinking and feeling? What are your toys
Right.
doing and thinking and
What
feeling?
can we
Like, yeah,
anthropomorphize next?
what can we do now? But yeah, this was definitely, I think, one of the earliest examples of that concept. And it's very successful in this. Like, you really believe that these dogs have their own little, like, their rules about how the house dogs are and the street dogs and all of the, like, it's very well sketched out. You understand where all the characters are, who's doing what a big deal it is when Lady has left her hat when she runs away from that shop. Like, it, the storytelling is so tight, so concise, and we have all the information we need to follow it. Love it. Jeff, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Not really, no. I mean, it is. I completely agree with everything that's just been said.
Donna, do you have
No,
anything to
notes.
add? Oh yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's so lovely to have a film where you have these beautiful characters and these beautiful dogs, and they are given a voice, because there are so many films where animals play such an important part of the film, but we don't hear them. You know, we don't know, like Toto in The Wizard of Oz, absolutely crucial character, but we never hear Toto's voice, or you know, anything, or even things that were popular of the time, like Lassie. You know, that it was just all expressed through the barks, and so it's really nice as a dog lover to sort of see this little. It feels like we're having a little secret peek into their inside world, which I think is lovely.
Adorable. Jeff, what's your second circle?
You've kind of already touched on it with your intro to this episode, but I just wanted to talk about the gestation period of this film and how many story iterations it went through to get made. I mean, we talked on the Treasure Planet episode of Three Circles about how long that took for that film to get made. This film puts that to shame, because the first inspiration for this came 30 years earlier. When Walt Disney gave his wife Lillian a little dog to keep her company while he was out working at the Disney Brothers studio. Lillian apparently didn't want a dog, but Walt gifted her a chow puppy on Christmas morning with the dog in a hat box. She was expecting a hat for Christmas, exactly the same way Lady is given to Darling by Jim Deere. In 1937, Joe Grant pitched an idea inspired by the antics of his English Springer Spaniel and gave Walt sketches of Lady. Story outline had been written by 1940, and in 1943, Disney decided to go ahead with the production. He then read this short story, Happy Dan, the Whistling Dog, and contacted Green, suggesting a romance between the dogs. He said, "Your dog and my dog have got to get together." Disney then heard a radio play in 1944 and contacted Charles Palmer. They paused the production before getting it back into production in 52, when Roy Disney encouraged Walt to get it back into production again. Ward Greene would ultimately write the novelization of the movie, but Joe Grant was given no on-screen credit, and his involvement in the film was largely forgotten about until a DVD special rectified this in the late 90s, I believe. So yeah, it's fascinating just the iterations this story went through, because the Siamese cats were originally called Nip and Tuck before they were called Siam. As I mentioned earlier on, the character of the rat, I think it was something like Harvey or Herman. The rat was meant to have been a more comedy character. All these different changes this story went through. It's amazing this film got made. 30 years in the making, this film. I can't believe that.
It was, as I was doing the research too, I couldn't believe how long this was in development and how many times it was, you know, taken off the burner, put back on the burner, this and that. Like, it was fascinating. It's a
Yeah, I
fascinating
had
story.
no idea. That's really cool.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
The first ideas for this film were before Snow White was released. That's how
Yeah,
old, that's how
that's
long the
wild.
ideas are going on. Yeah.
Like, it's so, and you just have to think about all those people in that studio, and that's how all of these movies happened. They were all bouncing ideas off of each other, and they were probably working on like 50 things at once. Just absolutely wild. All right, Donna, what's your third circle?
My third circle, I did touch on it earlier, but I'd like to talk about the color theory and how The colors really tell a story, and I love that. I'm a very visual person. I love it when you have very defined colors in films. One of my favorite films is La La Land, and not surprisingly, because I love a musical, but there's such storytelling through color in that. So it's something I always look for in film. And Lady and the Tramp has buckets of it. It really does. We've got, of course, you've got Lady. She's got the softer colors, the warm browns, and then you contrast that with the gray, the grayness of Tramp and how he's more urban. There's just beautiful scenes where you feel when you're in a sort of a domestic space or a safe space. It's very warm. There's lots of yellow and orange and cream tones, like Lady's home and the dinner table. It just gives it that like candlelit feel. And then when you have these romantic moments, there's lots of dusky pinks and deep reds and soft oranges. It just feels warm and intimate and sort of nostalgic. It's like a lamplight. And then, of course, to contrast that, you've got the danger scenes, which are usually very cool blues and muted purples, greys, like the dog pound, the storm, and that colder palette heightens that tension and that feeling that we're somewhere that we shouldn't be and we should be back home, because that's, a huge part of this film is the sense of belonging and looking for a home. And I think that when we're on these sort of urban scenes with Tramp, it's cold and it's sterile and it's grey, and then you return to Lady's home, and it's just warm. And I love how they use the colour palette to sort of guide us as the viewer what's safe and what isn't safe.
Oh, that's fascinating. I love that. Ian, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I and just to piggyback on that, I love the way that, the tramp is represented in, those grays of the city, the streets, the pound. Like that's the world he comes from. That's the world he, is familiar with and occupies, and yet is animated with such warmth that, Lady and the audience and, everyone else in the story overcomes their initial hesitation about who he is, what he represents, where he comes from, and he just wins people over with his force of personality and his warmth, and that comes through in how the character is animated and how they act with the other characters in the story. And I just think there's a lot of really thoughtful decisions that went into the making of this movie that maybe not even register the first time you watch it.
Oh, completely agree. Jeff, do you have any thoughts on the color theory?
I hadn't really recognized it before, but yeah, you're so right. I mean, I'm going to come back onto the dog pound itself later on, but yeah, it's fascinating to hear Donna talking about it because we've got all these different colors, and the colors that you associate with the characters. And yeah, I was going to say as well about Tramp being the sort of friendly character. He's obviously got certain people wrapped around his fingers. I mean, funnily enough, we were talking about accents earlier on. We haven't even mentioned the chefs yet from
Oh,
the
yes.
Italian restaurant.
That too.
But he's got them wrapped around his finger as well because he turns up. They go, "Oh yeah, is it Champ they call him?"
I
And they
think they
just
call
give
him
him
Butch.
food. Butch, sorry. And they just give him loads of food. And then Lady turns up on the scene as well, and they're happy to feed her too.
Yeah, he's got. That's one of my favorite parts, actually, just to sneak that in here. When he shows Lady just how much he has that neighborhood cased, man. He's like, I go here on this day and I get this here and then I go here. It's really that scene is hysterical. Ian, what's your last circle?
So you all have taken all of them,
Oh, yeah,
but
I know.
I just want to, I guess, circle back to, it's a small theme, I think, in the grand scheme of things, but I recognize that probably, there are some kids who are watching this movie and having the anxiety of being the focus of your parents' attention, and then there's a new arrival in the house. Like I certainly had a little bit of that myself, being an older brother. You know, I was 5 and a half when my brother was born, so I was definitely old enough to remember, like, oh, there is a change in the dynamics of this household, that I am not equipped to process properly. And I can imagine that that's something that viewers, particularly young viewers of this movie, could resonate with. And I think it probably, you know, probably is one of the many reasons for its staying power, is it does have these themes that you can still latch on to and recognize whether you're a child or an adult.
Yeah, that's a really good point to bring up because we hadn't really talked about that yet, and it kind of puts the whole plot in motion. So, yeah, that is an excellent, excellent point, and I think it handles that very well in the movie. Donna, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that that is really what triggers everything is the new arrival in the house, and I think that it really pinpoints to me that the whole theme of this film is about belonging and family, and whether that's, the family like the new baby or the family that they sort of find for themselves with Tramp joining at the home and everything. I think it's just lovely how it's such an important thing, the sense of belonging. Everybody wants that, even dogs.
Yes. Jeff, do you have any thoughts on this?
It's interesting as well because you see Lady trying to welcome this new member of the family as well. And, you know, we haven't talked about Aunt Sarah neither.
Ugh,
When
the less said about her, the better.
But when she's there, she's sort of looking lovingly into the baby's crib, and she's literally kicked out, put on a chain, and put in a kennel outside. And you know, that's what Tramp had been telling her was going to happen. You know, the baby comes in, you haven't got a warm bed to sleep on anymore, you're in the garden sleeping in a wooden kennel. And okay, it's not Jim Deere and Darling that's doing it, it's Aunt Sarah that's doing it. But as soon as the owner's back, as soon as Jim and Darling are back, they just take her straight back in again, which I think is, you know, good for them as well.
Yes, the relief I felt when Jim was like, "No, she's trying to tell us something." I was like, "Yes, listen to her.
Yes.
Listen to the dog." Like, oh my God, get this woman out of the house. She's the worst. Oh my Lord. Jeff, what's your third circle?
I want to talk about the dog pound, to be honest, because that scene. Now, I'll hold my hands up. At first, I was chuckling at the dog singing "Home Sweet Home" because it's such a cute scene before they start showing the other dogs in the pound, and then I started feeling really guilty for laughing because you see them in the absolutely terrible conditions they are. And that song is quickly followed by "He's a Tramp" to lighten the mood, but I was still thinking of the poor, mournful faces of the dog singing
I
at that
know.
point. And the singers are actually called the Mellow Men. Now we're going to be talking about them again, presumably on Three Circles, because they performed on Peter Pan, on
Yes.
Winnie the Pooh, The Jungle Book, Alice in Wonderland. They've provided backup vocals as well to some of the best-known artists of that era, including Rosemary Clooney, Bing Crosby, Doris Day, Arlo Guthrie, Frankie Lane, Joe Stafford, and some guy called Elvis.
Not familiar.
No, and Lady gets a real look into this life as she sees then an unclaimed dog being led up the corridor to quite a dark moment of the film, to be perfectly honest. And all this time I'm thinking, I was just laughing at the dog singing "Home Sweet Home" a few moments ago. So.
Quite a bit of Disney realism there for you right there.
That was a proper slap around the face, I tell
Oh, yes,
you.
100%. Ian, do you have any thoughts about the pound scene?
I almost mentioned it as one of my circles, but Jeff already clued us in that he wanted to talk about it. But I too found it really, like, I had sort of forgotten about the sequence, and then when we got to it, I was like, oh, right, you know, it's such an evocative sequence, and it makes you melancholy even as you're appreciating the performances of these other, you know, minor characters that we meet there. It's still it is not a happy place. You know, to go back to the color theory conversation, like it is not colored in, you know, the bright, happy tones we associate with bright, happy places in this movie. It's very much a place where bad things happen, and you don't want to have your main characters end up there. And certainly for me as a kid, it was again, you know, one of those foundational sort of data points for me and my concept of like, oh, like this is what a dog pound is. Like, yeah, sure, it's a 1955 movie about, you know, the turn of the century, but like in my mind, this was what happens in a dog pound today. And so I definitely was affected by those sequences, yeah.
Oh, Donna, do you have anything to add on the pound?
You mean that's not what happens in dog pounds today? Because I was hoping they'd all be singing in there. Now I'm very disappointed. That was the thing that was keeping me going with the thoughts of those little dogs in the pound, that at least they were having a real nice, jazz sing along.
Yes, with
Turns
choreography
out
and everything.
not so.
So sorry about that,
Yeah, it's
Donna.
okay, 'cause it's
Bitterly
my turn.
disappointed.
It's my turn, and I'm gonna leave us on a good note. And I also realized I skipped my second circle, but that's okay, because as Ian said, we've talked about everything in my notes. So there you
Right.
go. So my last circle is the fact that this movie showcases such a successful rom-com structure. It's a dog rom-com. It's amazing. We meet our leads, and then they have a great first date. And like, let's just say, because we've already given it its flowers, but the spaghetti scene is my favorite scene in the movie. And it's probably, if we all had to talk about it, it's probably everyone's favorite scene in the movie. The spaghetti scene is amazing. I co-sign everything that we said about the spaghetti scene. What a great first date. Oh my goodness. Since she learns all about his past girlfriends, and then she gets jealous. So we have a little rom-com conflict. But then he helps her save the day. And then she saves his life. And then he gives up his freewheeling existence to settle down with her. It's a dog rom-com.
It
Really
is.
is. It's like an unbelievable, perfect example of a rom-com, except it's two dogs. I wouldn't have it any different.
Donna, do you
Donna, do you have any thoughts on the rom-com of Lady and the Tramp?
I love it. It's kind of like almost a 1950s Pretty Woman, but with dogs.
Yes.
I mean, I kind of love that. It is so utterly romantic as well. I mean, oh, it's just dreamy. Yeah, it's a total rom-com. It's one of the best.
Is. It is. Critics agree. Now, they didn't at the time, but they agree now. Ian, what are your thoughts on the rom-com structure?
I agree. I think you're right. You know, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, like this was one of those early, for me, depictions of, yeah, like that sort of platonic, at least Hollywood ideal of this is what romance looks like. You know, this is what an odd couple overcoming their differences looks like. You know, there were a lot of the kind of tropes and concepts and themes that you would see in rom-coms at large, like you were saying, that were kind of coded into this in a very kind of child-oriented, family-friendly way. I was just gonna make a stupid joke about how, like, you know, there's no "I'll have what she's having" conversation, but like you still get an iconic eating scene.
That's very true. Oh gosh. Oh man. But yeah, that is true. Wow. Jeff, do you have anything to add?
Only that I was just still reeling from the thought of Donna's comment about this being an equivalent of Pretty Woman, because does that make Lady a... No, never mind.
No,
I'm not
no,
going down that.
no,
No.
tramp.
Tramp.
It's the other way around. Yeah,
All right, okay.
he's definitely
He's the
the person of the
ladies' man.
streets, we'll say.
Correct. There
Yeah.
you go. Yes,
But
very accurate.
he does walk around the streets as well, to be fair. No, never mind.
Does.
Yeah, it's I love it. It's perfect, to be honest, the rom-com analogy there. It's spot on.
Yeah. Oh, it is so good, and I am ready And I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of agreement on this question, but who is the MVP of Lady and the Tramp? Donna, do you have an MVP?
Oh gosh. So tricky. I love them all. I think for me, I'm gonna have to go with Lady because I think she has a big character arc. She starts off very much pampered princess and she's really shows a lot of bravery. She pushes herself into new things, new experiences, and she's not judgmental. She really does change a lot towards the end of that film. So for me, it's Lady, just because of how brave she is.
I love that. I love that. Ian, who's your MVP?
I think that's a really good point. I think I agree, Lady, because as you were saying, she has to do the most stepping outside of her comfort zone of any character in the movie. And you know, like the tramp, like what you see is what you get. She learns to see him for what he is, but he doesn't actually change that much, other than and not to minimize it, but he sort of settles down, for lack of a better word, at the end. But in terms of the assumptions about other characters, about the world, you know, there's a lot more that Lady doesn't know that she learns through the course of the film and learns about herself as well. So yeah, I think you make a really good point. I agree. I think it's certainly, as far as characters go, I think it has to be Lady.
Yeah. Jeff.
I think I would have lost a bet with you,
I
to be
know.
honest, Violet. Yeah.
I know. We had a different thought, but we don't all have to agree.
No, exactly. We were convinced that Peggy Lee was going to be across the board on this one. Do you know what? I'm going to go with Tramp.
Yeah.
We've had two mentions
Tramp's
of
great.
Lady. Let's go with Tramp. He's such a fun character in the film. And you know, we mentioned the journey that Lady goes on. Tramp goes on his own journey as well. He settles down, he becomes a family man by the end of the film. Do you know what? Yeah, Tramp.
I like it. I like it. Then I get to keep Peggy Lee for myself. So Peggy Lee is my MVP. So just for her songwriting, for her multiple vocal performances in the film, for the changes she made to the film for the better that we talked about earlier, and also for her landmark court victory for this film, I would like to say that Peggy Lee is the MVP of Lady and the Tramp. So, one last very quick thing I'm going to ask all of you. On Movieversaries, we like to ask, is this movie capital G great? Donna, is this movie capital G great?
It's all the capitals. It's great. I mean, it's timeless. Everyone
Yes.
can connect to it because everybody wants to belong and everybody wants home. And this film just captures both those things, that sense of finding your place in the world and being brave about crossing into different areas that you might not cross into had you not met those special people in your life. So for me, it's great for that because it's just a universal truth about belonging.
Ian, capital G, great.
Yeah, I for me it is always going to be. I guess I could understand it maybe not being the speed of everyone, you know, for what they want out of a Disney movie. For me, I think it's a great example of classic Disney, and yeah, that also includes a couple of elements that maybe haven't aged as well, but I think there's so much about this that is, like you said, timeless, that I think you have to appreciate it and, you know, and continue to celebrate it. I certainly will.
Yeah. Jeff, capital G, great.
Yeah, I would say so. It's nice to get a film that isn't your Snow Whites or your Cinderellas that you can look back and think this is a Disney classic with a capital C. It is timeless. I mean, the fact that it was set in the early 1900s at the time basically means that this film, I was going to say, doesn't date, but dates very well with a caveat.
Yes, yes. We have discussed the shortcomings, and yes, despite those shortcomings, which needed to be mentioned, I would say Lady and the Tramp is capital G great after 70 great years. Thank all of you for joining us today. This was just as much fun as I thought it was going to be. It's been a real joy. Donna, if people want to continue the conversation, where can they get a hold of you?
You can find me on TikTok under Donna Sings Vintage.
Love it.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes, of course. Ian, where can people find you online?
So, as you mentioned, I'm also on Movieversaries with you, talking about movies on a big, nice round number anniversary. And we sort of reassess and evaluate these films. And this is one of them. It was such a joy to talk about this one with you. You can also hear me on Illumination Above All, a Severance discussion podcast. We are Starfleet, one of our Starfleet discussion pod, Starfleet, one of our Star Trek discussion podcasts here on the network. Jeff is on the other one, Make It So, and a collector's commentary, right? The physical media podcast that is my newest venture.
And Jeff, where can they find you other than Three Circles, which we host together?
I can be found at NCC 17 Formula One and Blue Sky. As Ian just mentioned, I'm the host of Make It So, a Star Trek Legacy podcast, which can be found at Jean-Luc Podard on Blue Sky, and also the host of 8-Bit Back Issues, which can be found at linktree/8-Bit Back Issues.
And you can find me, because we've already mentioned my two podcasts, Movieversaries and Three Circles. The best place to find me is my Linktree. It's linktr.ee/violet.h.310. And thank you so much to my co-hosts, Jeff Owen and Ian Buckley, and to our special guest, Donna Jones, for joining us today, and to everyone who has tuned in. We very much hope you've enjoyed this special crossover episode. If you have, please subscribe to Three Circles and Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. Please check out the show notes for our links and don't hesitate to reach out on social media. We'd love to start a conversation with you. Thanks again for your company, and we'll see you real soon on Three Circles and Movieversaries.